Lunch with Leon.
He came running out of the police station and said, quick, this way. We went in there and the police officer said, quick, out the back. And threw us in a sort of police boat and shot us down the Thames. That all sounds very glamorous, and it is a memory, of course.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Lunch with Leon. And as you've just heard, we're talking to somebody with huge experience in the rail industry and an old friend of mine from our time together at Transport for London. I was really pleased to be able to talk to my old friend, Nigel Holness. And I started out by asking him how it really started.
Well, Liam, I've been in the industry, the rail industry, public transport industry, for coming up to 40 years. I can't believe how quickly the time has gone when I look back. But indeed, next February will be 40 years in the industry. And it's been an incredible journey. And of course, it's not over yet. I'm continuing to do lots of exciting things, which, I can share with you. But yeah, it all started 40 years ago, February. Gosh, when was that? 1986. I'm obviously a young sort of 19-year-old joining London Underground as a signalling technician, actually. Yeah, I mean, I learned an important lesson about my career very early on, that you get out of your career what you put into it. So something there for perhaps people listening in. And I did actually find that working at London Underground, it was a fabulous place for that. You know, I put myself out to learn and develop, and I got a lot of opportunity out of it. Some bumps along the way as well, of course, but I've just had a brilliant career today. As I say, it's not over yet.
No, it's brilliant. And so, look, you and I overlapped a bit in TFL, which was tremendous. And my goodness me, the world changed in the Underground in your time, and it's changed since then as well, and it's changed in TFL since then, and it's hardly recognisable now as the place we remember, is it?
No, that's right. I mean, when I joined London Underground, TFL didn't exist, of course, and now, of course, it's coming up to, in fact, this year, 25 years of TFL, and where has that time gone? Successive mayors, each interesting to work with, of course, and I think TfL has done a fabulous job working with different administrations, local administrations, national government, the Department of Transport, of course, and I'm sure they'll continue to do so. But yeah, when I started with London Underground, I started in the sort of signalling area, and I was fortunate enough to find myself in a position where I was testing and commissioning signalling systems, which is really interesting. I went through the sort of middle of doing shift work and this sort of thing, and ultimately I got a sort of break into management in London Underground. Of course, in my time in London Underground, we transitioned from effectively being a standalone unit to being part of Transport for London, much more of an integrated approach. It wasn't easy initially, of course, to get the thought of an integrated transport system through people's minds. People worked in sort of different camps almost, and different commissioners and MDs, etc., tried to make that change. I think today, actually, TfL is a lot more about providing an integrated transport system. Of course, it has a key role in supporting London and helping to drive the economy locally, but also nationally. Is playing a really important role in terms of sustainability and being sort of London's green sort of heartbeat, I think is the sort of vision at the moment. But of course, I left TfL now back in 2019. It was the third time I've left, actually. I was fortunate enough to get asked back to do different jobs, bigger jobs. And as I said, I had a fabulous time there. But I think, Leon, my sort of highlights from there was really all about working with people, particularly frontline people. I'm a sort of down-to-earth guy, so, I love being out there, on nights, on days, on the gate line, on the track, meeting people, talking to people, learning their stories. But, of course, all with a view of getting the job done as well. And, while I was there, I had a couple of incredible highlights. In a way, 7-7 was a highlight. And, of course, you were deeply involved in that as well. I was working on the Tube, and I was away with Mike Brown and Howard Collins and one or two other people. And, of course, the call came in.
As I remember, you were all in Docklands or Canary Wharf or something when it all happened, right?
That's right. We were there. I was actually the duty director for the Tube. I got a call from somebody to say something had happened. It was all unclear at the time. I asked that person to go away and find out a little bit more before coming back to me, which they did. And, of course, then the situation unfolded. So, we all jumped in a car. We didn't get too far very quickly. And then I remember Howard jumping out. There was a police station He came running out of the police station and said, "Quick, this way." We went in there, and the police officer said, "Quick, out the back," and threw us in a sort of police boat and shot us down the Thames. That all sounds very glamorous, and it is a memory, of course, but what we walked into when we entered 55 Broadway, the network control centre there, was obviously pretty devastating. And then the next few days unfolded. And, you know, I think that experience taught me a lot about leadership, a lot about resilience, but of course, a lot about teamwork and collaboration. And as I say, you know, I think the frontline people involved in that did an absolutely phenomenal job. No, I'm talking about, you know, bus workers and tube workers, but of course, you know, the emergency services as well. And of course, it's the 20th anniversary this year.
I was going to say, we're coming up at the time of recording, we're coming up on the anniversary. Almost certainly this will be broadcast after the anniversary. So I had nearly the same experience as you. I'd been at the G7 in Edinburgh the day before. And of course, that was the day, that day before, when London won the Olympics, and the mayor and top team were all in Singapore, of course. And I had just boarded my plane in Edinburgh and flown down to London normally. But when I landed at Heathrow, there was something going on. There was certainly no Piccadilly line into London. And then you could just feel, and people were talking, and there was a thing. So I eventually got a taxi. And we came to a halt on the M. Actually, we were stopped. That's right. We were stopped by the police for speeding. So I told the policeman who I was, and then gave us a blue light escort all the way on the rest of the M4. We went down the middle of the Hammersmith flyover, like between the two lanes of traffic. And they got me, I think, they got me to somewhere like Knightsbridge, which sort of, in any terms, was like decent walking distance by then. And as you said, it was just an extraordinary event. Not forgetting 2 weeks later, on the 21st of July, we had another dose of it as well. And they were defining moments for TfL, the organisation, and the people in it, for sure. And I've never forgotten, on the morning of the 8th of July, everyone, we were all at operating locations, because I think we all knew that if we didn't get the bus service and the underground service back running the following day in some normality, then we'd have much more trouble than we would have done. So I remember everybody being around first thing in the morning at depots, bus garages, stations, broadly saying, "I'm here, and if I'm here, it's safe for you to go." And it was as important to the frontline staff that we were there as it was for the passengers. And I just remember that incredible following day, the 8th of July, an incredible feeling of normality as people carried on. And I remember thinking, that's the reason why the terrorists will never succeed, because no matter what you do, you know, we're just going to keep going.
Yeah, I agree, Leon. I think that was a phenomenal achievement. I was obviously involved in getting the tube running up on the next day, notwithstanding the areas that we couldn't run, of course. And as you say, a phenomenal achievement. You know, so important to keep London moving, but also so important to send the message that you talked about. But, you know, so that was a key highlight for me. But, of course, the other one was the Olympic Games. Again, you were deeply involved in that. You know, I was sat in the Network Control Centre on the opening ceremony. Before that, we'd had a dress rehearsal.
Yeah, I remember.
We had an overturned rail on the central line. It's goodness me. You thought these things are sent to test you. But, yeah, again, what a phenomenal achievement that was. You know,
you see, you had your overturned rail on the central line. I had the closure of the Hammersmith flyover.
You did, yes.
Which was structurally unsafe and declared so in December 2011 on the main artery all the way from Heathrow Airport. But Nigel, if I remember, nothing pales into insignificance like the operations than the rehearsals we did, because in all the days of our rehearsals, I remember coming in one day, taking over as STOG, Senior Transport Operator Group. I came in for my STOG rehearsal, and that morning, during my simulation, there was a tanker full of golden syrup went over on the M4. There was a fire in Somerset House. There was a problem down on the river. And there were two Chinese athletes wanting political asylum, all on the same morning. And of course, when it came to the actual delivery of the games, Nigel, do you remember, we had very little to do?
That's right. No, it was incredible. I mean, I remember after the big dress rehearsal, I had to do a TV interview, and the reporter asked me, how could we be confident that everything would be okay on the Olympic Games. And of course, we knew that everybody was working in CFL behind the scenes to make it as good as it could be. And thankfully, it was brilliant. You know, I mean, I do remember Leon being in the network control center on the opening ceremony. And what a lot of people don't know is that we did have a problem with the Jubilee line whilst the event was going on, the opening ceremony, but we managed to get it back for the return traffic. But my heart was in my mouth, I tell you. But you know, the whole Olympic Games thing was a great experience as well. And I guess the third real highlight for me was being able to play a role in the opening of the Elizabeth line. That was great. I had the pleasure of, you know, working with a great bunch of people in TFL, within MTR, and within Crossrail, of course. And as you know, that, you know, it's been a big success. And well, you know, hopefully we'll continue to go from strength to strength.
No, indeed. And in fact, if the Elizabeth line had opened on time, I might have been at the ceremony, but in fact, I'd left by then, and it was a couple more years before it opened. The Elizabeth line reminds me of the Jubilee line extension in 1999. The whole delay, cost overrun, accusations, bad press, and so on, that was vitriolic in the run-up to the opening of both of those, disappeared overnight. In fact, I was on the Elizabeth line yesterday because I came into Heathrow. Do you know, not one person said to me, "You know, this is very nice, this Elizabeth line, but you know it was over budget and late, don't you?" Nobody says that, because as soon as it's there, for better or for worse, as soon as it's there, people just love it. The Jubilee line extension is phenomenally successful. In fact, without it, we couldn't have had the Olympics the way we did. And in the case of the Elizabeth line, it's done all the things and more that it was set out to do. The Heathrow connection, the Canary Wharf connection, the revitalisation in the sort of Abbey Wood area. Anybody who owns property on that end of the line has done very well out of it, and so on. The Elizabeth line is continuing to do everything anybody ever wanted.
Yeah, no, I agree. And as I say, it was a great collaboration between a lot of people and a lot of organisations. And, you know, as you're indicating, some people were part of it for a period of time and then they moved on. But when you look back, the whole number of people that worked on it was incredible and a great delivery.
So on the Elizabeth line, I got to drive during the pre-opening test phase, which was remarkable. I drove all the way from Abbey Wood to Paddington and back. And the thing that I think lots of people don't know, but you'll know because you were instrumental in it, is that wonderful manoeuvre at the Paddington end for terminating trains, where you get the train to drive itself into the siding. And as soon as you set it off, you yourself pack your bag, leave the cab, and walk to the other end in order to be 230 meters away by the time you're ready to go in
Indeed,
the opposite direction.
yes.
There is a case of a train with no driver in the cab moving itself on the mainline surface railway. And that's a big step forward, isn't it?
Oh, it is. I mean, the use of technology on the Elizabeth line, you know, is good. I mean, obviously, there could be more, but in order to get that across the line, of course, lots of careful discussions with colleagues in trade unions. But ultimately, you know, it's given benefit to customers, it's given benefit to be able to improve the timetable, increase capacity. And yeah, I mean, that's where we need to get to. And again, I've been fortunate in my time in the tube to be quite heavily involved in a lot of the line upgrades where, you know, we were introduced CBTC signalling and new rolling stock, new control rooms, etc. And, you know, that, again, the use of that sort of technology to drive up capacity, you know, so things like 36 trains an hour on the Victoria line, pretty phenomenal tail outs going out whilst the next train's headlights are coming in, of course. But as a, you know, now I'm working with as a consultant now, as an advisor, I get to do lots of different things, give me a great variety. I'm able to sort of bring to the fore my sort of knowledge experience gained through other projects. And you know, I was just going to talk briefly a little bit about some of the sort of lessons, I guess, from all of this. So currently I'm working in Australia on a couple of projects, Cross River Rail in Brisbane, Metro Tunnel project I've done some work for down in Melbourne. Of course, I did work in Sydney, running Metro Train Sydney, the operator and maintainer of the Sydney Metro, which is Australia's first fully automated railway. I'm also working actually on a couple of programs in Ireland, on the Cork Area Commuter Rail project, the Dart Plus project. So, you know, a lot of these projects, really, really interesting. I mean, you talked earlier about the, I heard someone call this issue a trilemma a few weeks ago, and I thought it's a fantastic analogy. You know, you've got cost, time, and the product. a trilemma, and you've got to get the balance right, because nobody wants to be late, nobody wants to be overspent, and you've got to deliver what it says on the tin. You mentioned earlier that deliver the great service, and a lot of the debate and discussion about cost overruns and time disappears. That doesn't mean, of course, that that's acceptable, because it isn't. But the point is, if you can get that balance right and you can get the right products over the line and deliver the benefit for customers, that deliver the benefit for cities and the sort of economy, create jobs, support accessibility, all the things that these great projects can deliver. But for me, the biggest thing about these projects is their complexity, the involvement of joint ventures, alliances, PPPs, and you get all of these tremendous sort of interfaces between organizations, technical interfaces, operational interfaces, commercial interfaces, in fact, almost cultural interfaces as well, which I actually think they're probably the biggest challenge in these projects, getting these organizations to work together. Why do we have this complexity? Because we need it to get the money in the ground, of course, a lot of the time. If we didn't have it, some of the projects perhaps wouldn't even have got started. But making it work through this complexity is quite difficult. And that's back to the point about working as a single team, working in collaboration. As we used to say on the Elizabeth line, owning the whole, focusing on the end goal is really what organizations need to do. And that's one of the sort of messages that I bring to these projects that I work with. I'm actually doing a little piece of work with HS2 at the moment, which has obviously been in the news recently. Some fantastic people there, Leon, really, working hard, going through a lot of changes. And, I'm convinced that program will get there. It's going to take a bit of time. It will make a difference. It's an incredible project, and it will make a difference.
Don't you think we were lucky? Because the thing the Olympics taught us is we had more interfaces than we'd ever seen in our lives before, hadn't we? So we couldn't vary the time because the opening ceremony was going to be the opening ceremony on the day of the opening ceremony, and that was it. In terms of cost, we were caught inside a particular fixed budget, and it had to be of good quality. And I think I remember we had those social events where we brought together every single agency that was working on the Olympics, whether it was local government, central government, all the various agencies, the media, the people, the practical people on the ground, all the people on the outside that were going to be supporting from, on my side, the Dial-A-Ride people and others. And we had those social events because we all got comfortable with each other. And I found that as we ran into the Olympics, which I've now never forgotten in all the other things we do, and in particular to your point about complex projects, you need everybody on the same burning deck facing in the same direction. Because if you do that, you've got people whose default answer, I always say, the default answer is yes, if I can. Their default answer is no, unless you persuade me otherwise. When you've got people who they're focused on the same thing that you're focused on, and their natural position is to say, I want to help you. Because if I help you deliver, that helped me deliver. And I think that Olympic legacy has been very important, and all the people work together on it. Because some of these complex interfaces we've got, as you describe, are there because there's got to be lots of people in it in order to get the funding.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I agree. The Olympic Games is probably the ultimate example of, an end goal, everybody focusing on the whole to deliver the program. And it was a phenomenal success. Of course, in major projects, there are organizations that, whilst they have ultimately the same end goal, there are different sort of priorities and needs of businesses, owning groups, of course, within that. So, it does require careful management. But, I find, essentially people just want to get the job done, but often there are some very challenging barriers. And often, of course, and I'll put my operator hat on now, it's the operator that gets squeezed to accommodate changes in scope or to introduce operational restrictions. And that requires great care and great skill on behalf of the operator and program to accommodate that. But of course, the operator has a key role in getting the railway open. And as I said, it was incredible to work with some ex-colleagues at TfL, MTR at the time, and Mark Wilde, of course, at Crossrail to get the Elizabeth line into service. And as I say, I'm applying some of those lessons elsewhere. So yeah, it's a really interesting time, I think, in rail at the moment. GBR, of course, still really looking to see, how that is going to shape up and what impact it's going to have on the industry, and I'll be watching that with great interest as we move forward. Of course, Sir Peter's there, leading the charge on that. So yeah, it'd be really interesting to see how that works out in the next year or two.
Well, it is interesting if you just replay the TfL top team in our day. Howard Collins in Transport for New South Wales, Peter Hendy as Minister, Mike Brown and Mark Wilde now at HS2. You and I working with some of these people overseas. It's an un I think it's an unsung thing about Britain. I mean, I don't know if you agree. I think Britain is leading the way on digital signalling on rail, isn't it? Isn't it extraordinary? It's not something we make a lot of noise about.
I agree, Leon. I think it's Australia's an interesting example. There are a lot of Brits out there, a lot of people from other countries, but you know, I can see out there how Brits have really helped shape the railways in Australia. You know, people like Rob Mason, of course, and Howard Collins. You know, lots of people out there that I know now that are from the UK have got experience from the UK industry, and they're taking it elsewhere. And yeah, you can see that with the sort of advent of you know, digital signalling, digital systems. In Australia, more to do, of course, but of course you can see it here in the UK, and of course you look at programs like the East Coast Digital Program, which is you know, is going to deliver a lot of positive benefits, I think, for the railway. So yeah, I mean, we've got to embrace digital technology. We've got to continue to embrace systems that help us, in a sense, predict and prevent, and you know, run the railway as smoothly as we can. Because at the end of the day, we're here for customers, right? We're here to keep the city's moving. We're here to keep the country moving. Working the railway is not an end into itself. There's an outcome, and that's all about the customers, journey time, reliability, and that's where the railway has got to get to, of course.
And I don't know if this happens to you, Peter Hendy on this very show talked about publicly about he has lots of friends when he goes to parties, because when people find out what you do, they've always got a story. So, and he tells a story on this very program. Go back, it's on episode 100. He was talking to Justin King. Apparently, nobody phones up the chairman of Sainsbury's to ask why the coffee is separate from the biscuits, but people do phone up the minister or do phone up the chief executive to ask why the Piccadilly line doesn't stop at Turnham Green other than on Sundays. And so there is something about that. So the one I always get, and you might get it too. So if I meet strangers or semi-strangers, and people say, "What do you do?" and the rest of it, they always have a question about why systems integration on transport is a problem. Now, you could answer that much better than I could, because it's much more your field than mine. My sort of amateur answer is to say, listen, when you do systems integration and you start to run it, if you're lucky, you might have 10,000 bugs, and if you're unlucky, you might have a million. And depending on where you land up, you've got to work your way through all of those and all of those and reduce the number. And every time you make changes to the code, you might improve the problem that you've got, but you might create a problem somewhere else. When people say, "Well, how long is this going to take?" My answer always is, "Well, if you're lucky and have a small number of bugs, and as you cure them, you don't create many more, you can have your railway sooner. But if you've got a million bugs and the changes you make cause other bugs, then you might not have it for a year." How does that sound?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, systems integration is a big issue. You know, the railway systems part of these major projects is a huge challenge, and often one that's just underestimated, of course. I think we saw in the Elizabeth line that you know, whilst a lot of the civils work had been completed, there was a bit of an underestimation, I think, to say the least, of the complexity and the difficulty and the scale of the task with railway systems. And I think, you know, I observe that in other major projects that I work with, people really need to you know, face into that. I think one of the good things Elizabeth line, because people look at it for lessons, and so you know, there is ongoing benefits from that project, particularly around systems and systems integration. And then it's back to that other point about, you know, there are often multiple organisations delivering these systems, getting people focused on the end result, getting the different supplier teams, delivery partners to work together to deliver the output. And the output is essentially a timetable. And the way you get that output is through, obviously, people and systems working together, systems coming from different organisations being integrated. And I think what's often also underestimated is the amount of time that it can take for things like software development cycles, where, you know, on the face of it might seem simple, but of course you've got all of the safety assessments, super critical, factory acceptance testing, site acceptance testing, and so on. So yeah, it's not easy. Back to your earlier point, when I'm at parties and social events, people are really interested and fascinated about public transport. I think, you know, it's an interesting industry in which to work. People knock it, of course, but when they realise that you work in it or have worked in it and have had all these different experiences, the number of questions that people ask you, and they are genuinely really interested. And A lot of the time, thankfully, I know the answer. Sometimes I don't, of course, but it is fascinating how it attracts people.
The one I get, which is always about, for example, on the roads, they say, why aren't the roadworks coordinated? Well, the answer is they are. This is the best we can do. And why is that? Well, because there's dozens of agencies are allowed to dig up the highway without permission, and all the utilities and comms and so on. And so therefore, if you don't consent to the roadworks being done when the utility wants to do it, it breaks, and then you've got to dig it up anyway. So the one I always get, and the other one I get, which you'll laugh about, is people say, why is the traffic so bad? And I said, well, frankly, consistently since 2003, we've been charging for it. And as the space is vacated on the road network, we've taken it away, which is why we have cycle lanes and wider pavements now than we ever did. So it's as congested as ever was. There's just less of it. And the light goes on in people's minds and say, ah, I see. You make it less attractive for people to drive, so they don't drive anymore. Yes. Ah, isn't it interesting? In all our years in TfL, we never quite said that as explicitly as we might have done. But people are generally very intelligent. They say, yeah, I get the hang of this now. So we've now got more cycling, more walking, more space, more pavement cafes, nicer environment, cleaner air, all the rest of it, because you've been, instead of trying to make the traffic go quicker, you've been trying to make the traffic go slower.
I guess the point is, Leon, it's a bigger picture to transport. I've talked about, supporting the economy, accessibility, but, the environment, sustainability, super important, of course. And, TfL have played a big role in that over the years. I think to the point about closures and so on, I mean, it's the same in the railway. We would, of course, not want to close the railway as often as we do, but you have to maintain it. You have to renew it. What we've got to do, of course, is find smarter ways of doing that. And again, that's where digital systems and remote intervention can help, rather than, of course, the last thing we would really want to do is put boots on the ground on the track and have manual ways of working. So there's some way to go in that, of course, but I think I can see the industry making some positive progress on the way in which the railway is maintained, renewed, and of course at the same time delivering safety benefits.
And I think rail is learning incredibly, funnily enough, from aviation. Because some time ago now, we got to fly on two engines across the Atlantic. And in fact, apart from the Airbus A380, there are hardly any four-engine aircraft left. And that's because the reliability is so phenomenal. And the reason the reliability is so good is because the communications between the aircraft and the ground, and between the engines and the manufacturers themselves, mean that we're getting way, way longer periods of extended maintenance intervals and very few failures. Because digitally, these engines are reporting themselves back to base every few seconds, and therefore it's possible to tell. So, and the railway is now doing the same, just as you describe about working smarter. We're learning, aren't we, to run it for longer, but not so long as it breaks. We run it for longer, so we get the most value out of it, and then we can plan the intervention at a time when it matters to the travelling public least, which I think is a remarkable progress compared with where we were.
It's absolutely the right thing to do. The use of prognostic and diagnostic systems in the railways is obviously it's a growth area, and one that's really important in terms of improving performance, but also reducing the time which we can't offer a service. So I think that's really important. And the other interesting area for me is the use of battery technology in trains. I've had the opportunity earlier in the year to go and have a look at Transport for Wales on behalf of an organisation I'm working with, and that was really interesting to look at tri-mode trains, these that work on overhead and battery and essentially a diesel backup. So that was really fascinating because battery technology's probably got quite a long way to go yet. It's still very heavy. There are still a number of restrictions, but again, it's part of this bigger picture that railways play in supporting sustainability, the environment, and of course, reliability, because batteries play a great part in that as well. So, I'm really interested to see how that unfolds over the coming years.
No, I agree with you entirely. And as you know, on the roadside, we brought the first electric buses into London in 2013. That's 12 years ago, which is just remarkable. And the energy density has gone through the roof. The costs have gone down, and the whole thing is able to run. We've got a very good mechanism in place. The slowest part of the whole process is getting the charging infrastructure into the bus garages, which of course is absolutely critical. So the country's got to keep ahead in terms of its power generation capability. But it's now starting, as you say, to feed its way through into battery technology on railway, which is just going to be absolutely huge. And in this particular case, by definition, that's the one where aviation is behind the curve, because they've got a lot further to go before we get into any sort of decarbonisation in big civil aviation. Whereas this way around, road is well ahead and rail is coming on very strongly, which I think is amazing. So look, you and I cross each other from time to time, in Sydney and in Brisbane and elsewhere on our travels. I was at the Queensland University back end of last year, which is a lovely bus ride on segregated tracks for 50 cents. And when you get to Queensland University, as you get off, the campus is sizzling because there's like thousands of brilliant people all concentrated into a narrow space, which I think is amazing. And you and I, of course, cross in Sydney because of what's happening with RATP Dev on my side and what you've been doing over there. And the Sydney transport system is really starting to look very smart. We've got beautiful trams in the CBD. We've got now autonomous metro, which is just brilliant. And there's even, Nigel, I'm sure you must, every time you must go looking too. One of the monorail stations is still there.
I didn't go looking for a monorail station, I must admit,
Next
but I
time,
do agree
Nigel.
with you. I do agree with your point about transport in Sydney and actually in Australia. I mean, some of these projects are really city shaping. So down in Melbourne, the Metro Tunnel project is joining two lines together under the city, delivering five magnificent CBD stations and will help transport travel in Melbourne. Sydney's a bit ahead of the curve, of course, with the metro product and the work that's going on with the Sydney trains and other forms of transport, of course, which you touch on. And of course, the city section in Sydney of the Sydney Metro has been a real game changer there. Another
And
extension to go, and another couple of lines being built, as you know.
there's that magnificent station, Martin's Place, Nigel, which I think Macquarie's we have to thank for building it for us.
It does, and I guess that illustrates the partnership again between the private sector and public transport providers, that they can deliver phenomenal outputs like that. A lot of these projects are delivering stations that are in many ways a bit like the Elizabeth Line stations. They're just cathedrals. They're incredible. They've got good art in them. I was never really a great fan of art and the railway. I was more focused on running the railway, of course, but now I can really appreciate it for what it is. And certainly in Australia, there's a lot there being done to really recognise the sort of Aboriginal people and traditional owners of the land there, which is great as well. And of course, in Brisbane, Cross River Rail, which is exactly what it says on the tin, a new rail river crossing under the river. And of course, in Brisbane, they are focused on 2032 Olympic Games. So lots of other public transport schemes going on in Brisbane. But generally, that sort of eastern coast of Australia has had a phenomenal amount of investment in rail. And I've been fortunate to be part of that and continue to work with organisations delivering those great projects. And in fact, Western Australia is also having a bit of a rail renaissance as well, a lot of investment over there. But they are learning quite a lot, I think, from the UK and, of course, other overseas organisations that are bringing a lot to Australia. So it'll be really interesting to see how that unfolds over the coming years. But so I think the really important thing, Leon, is that these projects have got to learn from the last one, and they've got to learn from the last one. And I don't think we're as good as that at that as we need to be. We're good at learning lessons, we're not always good at implementing them. And I think that's a really important point for taking forward. How can we really learn? How can we really embed? And be interesting to see how lessons learned are imported into other major projects.
No, indeed, indeed. And I did a workshop for Brisbane Olympics when I was there back end of last year, and I suddenly realised how old I'm going to be when the opening ceremony of the 2032 Olympic Games, and that itself will be 20 years since we had the Olympic Games in London, which is terrifying. So, Nigel, if people want to get in touch with you professionally and tap into your phenomenal global transport experience, which is pivoting around the world's most successful public transport Olympic Games, which of course was London 2012. Where do people find you?
Easiest way to get me, Leon, is through LinkedIn. I mean, a lot of people have got my contact details, of course, and know how to contact me, but easiest way is through LinkedIn.
Nigel, that's been phenomenal. Well, believe it or not, we've been talking for over half an hour, and we could probably have talked for another hour or two. Let's draw stumps there. So my guest today has been Nigel Holness, who is a global transport expert, especially in rail. Nigel has gone on to work in some of the most exciting railway cities now around the world. So Lunch with Leon is produced in conjunction with Passenger Transport Magazine. You'll find them at passengertransport.co.uk. You'll find Nigel on his LinkedIn, Nigel Holness. You'll find him. He's there because he's got a long CV and he's right at the top of the list. And Nigel, you and I work together really well for so long. We had a happy time. We're still running into each other in different places, and thanks very much indeed for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Leon.
Lunch with Leon was presented by Leon Daniels, and his guest was Nigel Holness. PR support is from Stark Communications, and the program is produced in association with Passenger Transport Magazine. Give us a review and a rating wherever you get your podcasts.